Let's start with where we left off last time. We were was about trying to implement the Deckers algorithm, and we ran out of time. So I've decided to continue today by having a look at the pure version without any further annotations. So that looks something like that. This is the Deckers algorithm that we have seen in the lecture. And the thing was now that we that our task was to somehow make it obvious that the protocol that this Decker algorithm has does not work in an environment where we have a relaxed memory model. So, how can we make something like that visible? Well, the idea is that the core thing why we do all that is that we want to have that kind of critical section being accessed only one thread at a time. Yes, please.
The lights?
So we would have to come up with a way to show that that specific area would only be accessed one thread at a time. So I don't know whether you had a look at the solution in the sheet already, but if not, let's maybe think about, can you imagine a way how to achieve that? Critical sections, it's always all about some kind of invariant that you assume that holds whenever you're not in a critical section. And within the critical section, you're allowed to temporarily break it. So with that, we could try to, for instance, create a data race, assuming that several of the threads would access the same thing. And in case that we are outside of the critical section, we would try to reestablish the invariant. We have already created such a data item over here, on which we could try to enforce an invariant. And the easiest invariant would be, well, that thing remains exactly as it has been throughout the whole program execution. If that is our invariant, then we might temporarily break our invariant by just increasing that thing and decreasing it once again. And with that, we should have our invariant outside of the critical sections intact, and that should be fine. So why not just add an amount to data and remove once again. And in order to somehow show that our assertion remains the same, we could just try to assert that data is zero throughout our program. Okay. So, why not try that out? How can we do that? We take the line from over here. And put it there. And, well, looks like the whole thing has failed, well, from our point of view, pretty immediately. That does not necessarily mean that the thing was running into a crash directly. Let's try to make it more observable what's actually happening over there by just adding prints. And, well, we're interested in the thread ID of whoever is accessing right now. We have had this thread ID in our local variables. There is my... there it is. Okay, then thread ID, and let's also give a clue about what we actually want to give out. So we now put out the thread ID and the according value of the data field. And okay, let's... why? So let's do this one and that one, and you see, there's a whole lot of accesses where everything is just all right. We could add a counter now, but I think you get the point. So there's a lot of cases where everything goes fine, but finally, in the end, we get to a situation where we get a data race where thread ID 1 is... well, accessing the whole thing and increases, and it so happens that the second thread also increases before the first thread, or just its increment before the first thread gets the chance to restore the invariant again, and thus we get a value of 2 here. Good. So that's how you could show this, this situation that we have critical section that's not protected enough. And we said that this would be due to the reason that we have the cache lines that have write buffers and invalidate buffers. Now would be the question, how can we in any way get rid of something like that? And the answer, of course, is something that we had in the slides, and that was introduction of load and store fences. So the thing is, now we need some way of telling our algorithm that there needs to be load fences and store fences. You remember how to apply them, maybe? What's the rule of thumb? Well, load fences in front of every read from a common variable and store fence after every write from a common variable. So the issue would be the flag is something which is commonly used, and the turn thing would be a variable that's commonly used, and the data then doesn't matter so much because the area over there is then protected and can be assumed to be exclusively used there. So let's start adding these things. So we also need some way of expressing that we want to have a fence over there, and at least in the GCC way, what we do is we have one single instruction instead of several, so we can only use one memory barrier. If we Google about that, we will see that the actual syntax for that would be this synchronize instruction. That would be the one that is responsible for performing these memory barriers. So that is the thing we need to add. Now the question is, where do we need fences? Well, after a write to a common variable, so that here is already a write to the flag, so we need something like that here. But also in front of every read of a common variable. So this turns out to be a read of a common variable. So maybe let's just add synchronize over here. And with that, we should get the chance to have a store fence after this thing. And at the same time, because this sync synchronize is memory fence that is as well a load fence as well as a store fence, we also can have a barrier in front of this common read thing. So that should be fine. Okay, then let's continue. There is an access to the turn variable. It's a guard, so we have a read access. So in principle, we would need load in front of it. So let's do that. Then there's a write. So we, after this thing, we should put a store fence. But all the same, we have directly behind, we have an application of a load fence. And since we only have a common M fence, just put it in there like this. So we can merge subsequent things to a common M fence. Then in there, we would have to put a synchronize again. However, I think this is followed by the while loop condition evaluation directly once again. So instead of putting the write barrier in there, we can rely on the memory barrier over here to be applied directly after the flag has been written to. So don't have to add anything over here. If you, of course, are unsure, you can put it in there, but this will just lead to another fence being executed in there. So apart from that, I think we're good. Then there's the critical section, of course. And here we have another write to turn. This is once again after a write to common variable, so we have to add the sync synchronized. And then there is another flag written, so we have to add something over here. I think, well, although this is the end of a loop, and it continues over here, I think there's no synchronize here, so yeah, I think we should add something like this here. Okay. So let's recompile. Oh. Okay. Have to go get for the right header file. Something over here. Oh, Mel. Ugh, spelling. But it seems that I have not been the only one doing that mistake. Well, you're free to correct me in such cases, or any other case that you have a question. So, that looks better now. Okay. So it looks like that thing would be better now, but there's a lot of output cluttering in my console, so let's maybe remove this one. Ah, so there's no assertion anymore. So. With that, we have created the barriers necessary to keep the correct values in the cache lines, and have eliminated our race for the data element. Good. Yes?
In the previous exercise, you always assumed that shared variables on different cache lines. But in this case, they must be in the same cache lines.
Do they?
They
might be in the same cache line, yes.
Well,
it's for me it's not clear where they actually reside. So, I'm also unclear whether it's completely dependent on whether they are in the same cache line or not, depending on the exact data layout. Well, I think the problem was that there was these write buffers and invalidate buffers, so I'm not sure whether they being in different cache lines would help so much.
No. The assumption was if they are different cache lines, there is this problem with these draw buffers.
Is it really? Was it a necessary assumption?
I thought so. I'm not really sure.
Well, it was something to make the drawings easier. But it's not from my perspective, it's not a necessary condition for the whole thing to fail. So that was more of having convenient modeling, but it's not necessarily the case that you need to have them in different cache lines. It's merely these buffered things that defer the correct update in the cache lines, whatever is in that cache line. Good. So, with that. I think we made DECA great again, and we can now move over to the next best thing in line, which would be sheet number 3. And it's once again all about all about implementing, and in this case it's the bumper allocation. I don't know whether you have the slides in memory as well as I have, so let's maybe start up another instance. I think it was in the logs. Is there something? No, it's not. Let's look for the thing. Oh, is it in there even? Thought it would be, yeah, over here. So that was the bumper memory allocation. So the crucial thing was to look at that part where we have two subsequent instructions that need to be atomic for several threads to be able to allocate safely in parallel. So the idea would be to implement the bumper allocation. Well, of course, something like the garbage collection is a little bit far-fetched, so let's remove that. And in principle, if we remove that and don't actually use the memory in question, then it's also not so crucial to have a heap at all. So it boils down to calling a lock like the one over here, where we just essentially perform the update on the first free pointer and return the start value and have some kind of check over here. But even that is not so necessary directly. So that would be the things to concentrate on in order to somehow demonstrate that there's inconsistent results in there. And yeah, let's maybe just try to do something with that. So let's look at code. Well, we don't need that. But let's have a look at this one. So I've done a little bit of work for you already by creating the skeleton of the bumper. So I think that should be already the most crucial parts here. Well, I'm on a 2-core machine, so that should be sufficient. We have this heap structure, which is just allocating memory anyway, so we don't necessarily need that, but anyway. We have the allocation as my alloc. What it essentially does is it extracts the value of the first free pointer to a local variable, adds the parameter to the first free, and essentially in the end then returns the start thing. Then we have the kind of experimental setup, in the sense that we here create a thread we call allocator, and we we create several of those in order to compete for the common memory area, and we do so by executing a lot of times in parallel the allocation, and we only allocate one byte, but that's can choose anything over here. We'll just do it like that in order to be able to, in the end, verify what the outcome is in terms of how many times have I done my allocation and did I do it correctly. And if I do a convenient number times one, I can more easily see what I have done on that thing afterwards. And apart from that, what I do is I create times our thread number, thread data structures, and I run through all of these things and create threads with the allocators as their main functions. And then I join again, so I wait for termination of all of those until they have this very large number of allocations done, and then I put out the number of, well, the difference between first free and the start address of my heap, which would turn out to be number of thread times the number of allocations that I did times the size of the allocation. So that should be something with a 2 in the beginning and a lot of zeros after that. If that's not such a number, then we've hit a problem in there. So let's try that out. Once again, I'm a lousy programmer, but so much about the warnings. It's still, well, I would say that's quite far off the number with the many zeros in the end. So, yeah, there seems to have been quite a lot of conflicts that I run into. Of course, well, nobody said that reading from memory and doing our increment would be atomic in any way. And if we don't protect it with anything else, then we might run into problems pretty fast. And that's what we have seen. Now, what can we do about that? Well, we've had the roundup for that thing on Wednesday, just a few days ago. So we can try to choose an appropriate algorithm from our list of algorithms, depending on what expressiveness we actually need and what features we actually need. So here we would of course want something that doesn't block us or doesn't have too much overhead, and also would be expressive enough to be able to represent the same algorithm as we had before, which is essentially read and add. And, well, since it's only a two-liner and perfectly fits our description of this fetch and add type instructions, let's maybe just do something like this. First of all, we should maybe separate these lines, because I can't, I have to declare in a separate line if I do something else with that afterwards. So these are the lines in question that we need to replace. So we need to look out for a convenient implementation of these things. So is there no internet on there? Oh, for Christ's sake. Okay. Well, in principle, we would start now Googling for atomic log-free and GCC in order to get an idea about what you can actually apply there. And turns out that there's this API things. I don't know the person who told about that was sitting there in the lecture, but I can't remember who it was actually. But yeah, there is API methods for that. And turns out that the newer standards of C, where they actually have specified something like memory models, have a kind of a standardized way to access these parts, these functionalities now. And yeah, that's something which is also included in GCC, the more modern versions. So if we scroll down the relevant page, then we will see that there's the instructions that are prefixed with this atomic, which already sound quite promising for us. And then you can select what kind of instruction you would actually need. And for our purposes, what we want to do is we want to fetch and add. And that's exactly what we find in there. There's this fetch and add. And that should kind of replace the things over here. So we can go here and remove those. And we have to, of course, say what we actually want to fetch and add. So we need a target on which to perform the modification, which is the first three. That is the one that needs to be incremented. We need the amount that we want to increment the whole thing, which is the size. And the start thing is our local variable. That is what's given back. And then there's one last thing. In this C++ 11 things, we have to specify the memory model on which this thing should actually work. So they actually have something like a specified memory model now. And well, you already see the thing here, atomic relax. So we have a relaxed memory model on which to operate here. So that would be the thing to use. So far, so good. Yes?
Two questions. First, you said it's C++ 11.
Yeah.
Are you coding in C or C++ 9? Or some mixture in between, like C++ without classes?
I think also the C standard has now finally gone to a memory model in there. So, well, in that case, I was a bit... Sorry?
We just do what we know. It doesn't
matter. Turns out that I have found these things today in the morning for myself. Even so, before that, there has been an extension of GCC that was ported from the Itanium ABI. And there we had something different, which was, well, only in the sense of it was different in the prefix, and apart from that, it was pretty similar fetch and add like this, just without the last parameter. So I haven't really checked whether you have that in C++ or C only. I was just pleased to see that they have kind of started something standardized now. I would have to look that up, whether it's from the C or C++ part.
Okay.
So,
do we have to know this for the exam or whatever? Because you said we're Googling it now and we have to look up. So
the thing is,
it seems like something you always need and really have to know.
Yeah, so that's the question, whether something like that is really can make it really into a concrete assignment in the exam. And well, since it is a lot about API and well, just concrete things that you would look up anyway, I'm not such a big fan of having to learn by heart API things and all that. And that's also why the slides are a little bit more general than these things over here. The tutorial sessions have clearly more to them than just the exam thing. I just assumed that you would be interested in how these things look in practice, because on the slides they are pretty well, they are simplified, they are boiled down to the core things. So here you have the chance to really see how that would work hands-on, but of course I can't make you program without without documentation. So, yeah.
So we more have to recognize what happens, but not really know.
You should pay attention to what's actually happening there. It should give you an idea of how these systems behave in practice. but, well, we can't directly have that in the exam. So these are the things that have been there before, and they are working exactly like this, just without the atomic relaxed parameter that was not there in the Tanium model. And yeah, I thought it would be better to move on to something which seems to be actually standardized between compiler providers. So yeah, that's why I went over to this atomic fetch add thing. Good. So, let's have a look at how that turns out. Oh, the buttons are a little bit screwed up if you do these recording things, so that's why I always go these more difficult ways, like copying. Oh, was it? Let's hope that... I'm not sure whether that was, well, is that, yeah, so it wasn't compiled before. So, in this case, it seems in order. So we have two threads and this constant, which is, yeah, pretty much same length as the one before. So that should be fine. Good. Apart from that, there's also a version with inline assembler, but I think the learning outcome from switching to inline assembler is pretty negligible. Well, you can't learn so much from that. So you can just read that in the solution sheet. So it doesn't make much of a difference. In principle, the atomic fetch and add instruction, like here, is just using that inline assembly thing anyway. So it's pretty much the same. So let's write that out to bumper with fetch and add, and let's move on to the second implementation with the semaphore. So we can have a look at these two solutions, semaphores, where the another way of kind of a synchronization algorithm that we had in the lecture, and that was also a way to create something like a guard for a critical section. So we just have to lock the relevant parts of our software. So let's get rid of the atomic fetch and add, but instead choose the old algorithm. Just you have to start the critical section over here and end it here like this. With for that, well, we could have done the research on that one if the Beamer would cooperate. So let's just magically just know about what we actually have to do. So there's this concept of the POSIX threads and its semaphores in the GCC already in there. And for that to work, you can, well, you have to first of all add a data structure that has everything that the mutex actually needs. So, well, the semaphore data structure that we can introduce in there. This time I can't really imagine that there would be some kind of typing, some kind of spelling error. So maybe there was some kind of header that I needed to add. So let's have a look. Thank you very much. It's like internet by call. Like that?
Yes.
And already gone away? Fine. So, and the semantics for that is you have to have an acquire and release, and that is done with that's nice, isn't it? We have this sem wait that is actually the semantics for that. They have chosen wait for that. Well, probably waits for entry into this semaphore, and then there's the semaphore, well, what is the other one? Yeah, turns out to be post. Don't question me about the naming. I don't really know, but yeah. Naming is one thing in which you will encounter throughout the whole lecture is, well, not as standardized as you would wish it to be throughout different programming languages and libraries and all that. And just turns out that post is the name in the POSIX threads semaphores, which you have to use to release your semaphore. So, yeah, that's already all that you have to do there. So, let's oh. Christ's sake. Just my crappy C programmer skills warnings, and we can execute that thing. Well, the second task in the implementation was to compare the implementations considering correctness and performance. Well, it still remains open whether the whole thing was correct and terminates in any way, but if it does, then I think we already have our result in terms of performance. We always have one thing that we can do. Just take zeros away. Oh no. So before we are being over ambitious, let's maybe just see whether the whole thing terminates in any way.
Did you initialize the setup for
it? No, I didn't. Is there an initialization procedure there for the semaphore? I don't remember.
Sem_init.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah. I think I have to do that in the main somewhere. That should do it. Did I call it Sem?
No, we have to do two additional parameters.
Oh, we need... sorry?
0 and 1.
What do we stand for?
Yeah, that would be an...
0 is
the
sum other parameter, I don't know, and 1 is the number of...
That's the initial value of the semaphore, isn't it? Okay, and this one... Such a pity that I don't have the documentation open. Ah, that's the shared parameter. It gets whether the semaphore is to be shared between threads of a process or between processes. Well, if p-shared has the value 0, then the semaphore is shared between the threads of a process. Yeah, so that's what we want to have. So... So it's about this one, and we'll say if it has the value 0, then the semaphore is shared between the threads of a process, like this. So that's what we need here, and then we also have the value, and yeah, that's just the counter value for the thing. So. Good. Thanks. So we need something like this. Good. That should allow us for higher numbers again. Better now. Now I have to, in order to compare those things, I should maybe actually really try to count how many zeros I have there. So in bumper C we have 100 million. For that it should be like this. Okay. Okay, so now there is something like that. We can now do a time on the bumper. That was the implementation with the fetch and add. And then we can do a time on the bumper. Oh, no, time with bumper semaphore. Yeah, and if you remember how fast that was, we can imagine that we have to wait a little bit. So, I think the result is quite obvious here. So if we have the choice and if we don't need the expressivity of something like the locking algorithms, then we should really consider something like the atomic fetch and add and compare and swap and all these things, as in practice they have really by just dimensions better runtime than if we decide to do something with locking data structures. It's, yeah, it's almost times 10 the user time that we have in there. So, yeah, there's a lot of differences between these variants. So I think that's maybe something to take away for you if you not only after exam questions, but also for your personal programming. If you can come up with log-free data structures and algorithms for your thing, well, and if it's the bottleneck for your algorithm, try something like these log-free algorithms. Okay, so is there still any question on the bumper? No. Then maybe let's move on to monitors. So I think we don't need that anymore. And also this one can go. So it's about trying to equip another algorithm with log data structures, and this time it's the double-ended queue. Okay, so that should be the version that we all have on our exercise sheets anyway. So first, a quick glance on how the whole thing is realized should already give us a short overview. So there is struct for the node within such a doubly linked queue, where we have a reference to the left neighbor and the right neighbor, and the data that is carried in that item. Then we have an anchor, in the sense that's the management data element, where we have a pointer to the left end of the in this case the right end of the queue, in this case the left end of the queue, so that this acts kind of the connection piece between those things, points to a certain fraction of the whole list that is left to right, assumed to be the start in points for left and right. Then there's method that's offering put something to the left side of the thing. So you give it a queue data structure and a value, and what it does is it just allocates a new node for us and sets the value in there, and then it starts modifying the actual list and updating the old elements and putting the new elements inside. So that is something which of course alters the invariant that this thing always needs to have intact chains of pointers that go around and never leave in an invalid dangling element. So here we momentarily break the pointers of these things, and have to reestablish the correct links later on. So yeah, that is something that we need to do in a protected way if we need to access this queue in parallel. Then there's pop right, which is accessing the other end of the doubly linked list. And, well, what's there to say? We get ourselves the kind of starting point in our list and manipulate its internals. We terminate with minus one in case that we realize that there's no actual value stored inside the queue, and then we start modifying the queue in the right points and return the obtained element, of course not before we have freed the old management data. Yeah, then there's our first thing that we need to implement. That is a for all method, which would run through all the elements in the queue and execute the callback function that we get here on giving the queue and the respective integer. What is that meant to be? Well, it's on the items of this list. So what is that supposed to mean? In that case, it's the that's already what we think it to be. So that would be the queue, and I think that would be the actual value on which to work. Yeah, then there's the main routine where we just set up our experimental workspace, where we have the WNQ initialized, where we have Sentinel on there created. We set up the state of the whole system, and then we can start our experiments with filling the whole thing with an initial with a few initial values in order to prepare something that will lead to a deadlock, and then we will use the for all to actually produce a deadlock. So that is kind of the setup that we are supposed to fulfill in there in order to make sure that a re-entrant mutex would be a good idea. So for that, once again, missing my research laptop connected to the monitors here. So the thing was that we would like to introduce pthread mutexes here, because they have a quite good interface in terms of, well, you can configure them as in a way that they either act as the general mutex or even as a re-entrant mutex, and in that sense they are kind of something like a monitor. So in order for that to work, what do we need? Well, we for once need, obviously it's mentioned in there that we need one general mutex in there, and we should associate that with a W and a Q. So we should probably store that in here. So for that we have the pthread mutex type. So that's our, well, that's maybe S. Well, I think that was originally for semaphore, but that doesn't matter. Let's call it S. Doesn't matter how it's called anyway. And this time we don't do the same mistake as last time, so let's initialize our data structure in some way. So if we have the data structure allocated, then we can access that. So we have S, and S should be, well, it's a pointer, so we also need a malloc here. And we want to malloc the size of pthread mutex type. Was it? What's it saying here? Should work, principle. Also, we need to cast. Like that. Maybe a missing pthread library or something. Yeah, looks like that. Okay, and also my compilation then should probably at some point work with pthreads. Still? Okay. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. laptop keyboards, everyone. We love them. Okay, so now we have the memory for that. We should probably also initialize. With pthreaded mutex init, and we can hand the pointer to the pthread mutex there, and we then might need some other arguments over there. So let's have a look at what we can do there. Man pthread mutex init. Oh, how nice. It's it's once again typo. No, it's not. Okay. Maybe you don't have the thing over here, but well, in summary, what I can use here is I can parameterize the way that our mutex behaves later on in the program, and here is the point where I can actually configure whether I want to have a re-entrant mutex or not. And in our case, we can just do with the default and don't use any configuration attributes. So I will just put nothing in there, and that should do. However, in the end, I should correctly try to get rid of the mutex, and that was, I think, QS, so I have to destroy the whole thing, and also I exit the whole thing. So that is just kind of a footer that we always need when we use these pthread mutexes. Okay. So with that done, we can now start having fun with mutexes. So we have push left, for example. That was the first one that we have looked into, and in there we already have said that there would be need for protection. There is modifications on the old queue elements, and they somehow depend on values that we start reading from here. So these things need to somehow be atomic, otherwise we will have a broken invariance, because we might introduce some races on the concrete way that the pointers are going. So we should protect that area, and well, it's just a matter of locking and unlocking. So let's do that. Pthread, I think mutex it is, yeah. Lock is the thing that we're going to do, and it already tells us what to actually do. So we need the mutex there, and we have only one for that, and that's this one. So with that, we have acquired the lock, and after we have performed our changes to the whole thing, we then what do we have here? Oh, it's unlock. Seems to be quite reasonably named, so already quite nice. Then we have the reference to the mutex itself. So So far, so good. Nothing too complicated over there. But that's not all. If we only protect this push left and nothing else, we will probably end up with arrays with the rest of the accessor functions. So there's still the pop right. That's also accessing the data structures in there, just not in this line. That's just a pointer declaration. And the well, there we already have the start of the whole thing. The left sentinel is something that we read from there. The right sentinel over here. Yeah. So we will just start with protecting everything from here. Pthread mutex lock was our thing. QS. And well, the free is something that probably doesn't need to be protected anymore because that's just on the an old node, as well as I think this one here is the last instruction that's still somehow sensitive. So over here we can. Unlock. Are we done? Yeah.
If you enter the return minus one part, the mutex won't be unlocked.
So we're not done yet. Instead, we still need to perform thread mutex unlock with QS. Convenient? Okay. So that's one thing to maybe remember if we have something like a monitor implementation, or, well, in this case it's a mutex implementation with explicit instructions that tell about how to acquire and how to release such a lock, then, well, it's a lot more thoughts involved than we if we had something like this atomic block or something where we could just mark the whole thing and in case that a return would jump out of my block, I would have the compiler figure out when to actually release the lock. In our case, we have to manually place the release of the lock and in all cases, like these branches here. And yeah, that can be quite tricky if you don't realize directly that there is a branch in the control flow that takes you out of the out of your procedure body in that case, for example. Okay, so far so good. Then there's also the for all to do. Of course, we first of all need some kind of implementation of what we should actually do. So let's maybe do that with a for loop. And well, we need some kind of iterating structure through the whole thing. So let's get ourselves such a Q element for the loop. And this Q element is then Q left, and from there right part, and we iterate until we have that queue, have reached the queue right. And what we do is qn will be qn to the right. Oh, where did I? That was this one. And what do we want to do there? We want to execute the callback on data and qn. Okay, that is a for all of the callback like this. Good. So this is something that also needs to be atomic, otherwise this for all would have to be iterated separately, and that for the for all we have the semantics that everything should work just like a transaction. So for that to be, we should also protect everything with a lock. Like this. And actually astonished that today we don't have people pressing into the room, although it's already 5 to 10, but yeah. Okay, so we have made our for all in that case mutex saved, so we can try to set up an environment on which to work now. And let's first of all fill. Here we go. First of all, fill our queue with the first few things. And then perform for all on the queue. The casted version of the push left, that's not yet everything. We have a void over here with that. We should have the whole thing. Is the for all typed correctly? Oh no, it's not. So that would be the preparations for the actual setup. I think we're gonna continue next time with that. So but I think with that you already have the necessary information to conduct the experiments yourself. And remember, we have already encountered that there's an unknown parameter over here which we can explore with the help of Google and our intuition, and try to make the whole thing re-entrant, which would then solve our problem we run into now. But let's maybe shut the whole thing down and start again next time. So we'll see us on Wednesday again, and so have a nice weekend and goodbye.